I think any senator has the right and the duty to vote against somebody who's been nominated for the Supreme Court if you profoundly disagree with that person's constitutional philosophy. And if that philosophy is not the same as yours, if you're sitting there as a senator. But unfortunately, nobody's honest about that, and that's not what goes on. What goes on ever since the Robert Bork nomination is, let's see how we can destroy the character of this person.
But isn't the question of whether a sitting president could be indicted or investigated, isn't that a matter of constitutional philosophy?
Oh, it is. I'm not saying you wouldn't ask about that. The recent tradition is the nominees are not going to answer any question that might come before them. They speak in relatively vague generalities.
Okay, you weren't saying
but
that that's the kind of
gotcha. But it's a totally legitimate question. Sorry to talk over you.
Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, tweeted that the White House's decision to withhold pages and pages of documents about Kavanaugh's record has all the makings of a cover-up. Those are the words of Chuck Schumer. Do you think those documents should be released to give senators a better idea of his record?
Not if it will delay his nomination to the point that we go beyond the midterms, no. And I think that's what's going on there. Look, if there's anybody who's a known quantity, it's Brett Kavanaugh. He's been on the bench about 12 years. He has hundreds of opinions, very outstanding opinions, outstandingly written opinions. He has broad support among a broad spectrum of politics and law. So I don't think it's all, again, looking for the gotcha moment, and that's what they think they're going to have in those papers.
Talk to me about how, if you are Brett Kavanaugh, how you are preparing for a hearing like this. I mean, you are going to be sitting there for hours taking questions. What do you do to get in a mental space if you're a lawyer like Brett Kavanaugh to be ready for this big week?
It's like preparing for your first argument in front of the Supreme Court. I'm sure they've gone through several practice sessions, and he's a very, very well-prepared, studious fellow and a careful fellow and has always been that way. He was that way when I worked with him, and it was one of the impressive things about him.
Tell me anything that you learned about him in working alongside him in Kenneth Starr's team that might tell us something about what kind of Supreme Court justice he would be.
Well, he was very mature. You got to remember, he was a young guy, but we had a lot of respect for him because Ken had chosen him to really head up the litigation team, the Brain Trust. And like I said, I thought he was wise beyond his years, quiet with a wry sense of humor. He had a great sense of humor. He laughed at every one of my jokes. And to me, that's the number one indicator of a person's sense of humor.
So maybe
when the situation called for him to be serious, he could be quite serious.
Solomon Weisenberg is a partner at Nelson Mullins Law Office in Washington, D.C., and worked on Kenneth Starr's team alongside Brett Kavanaugh, who will be in his confirmation hearings this week. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The body of Senator John McCain is now buried on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Academy, from which he graduated as a young man. NPR's Shannon Van Sant reports.
Yesterday's burial for McCain followed a week of observances in Arizona and Washington, D.C. McCain became the 31st American to lie in state in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, en route to a Saturday memorial service, where official Washington and McCain's family paid tribute. His daughter, Megan, gave a powerful eulogy that did not name President Trump, but seemed to be aimed at him.
The America of John McCain has no need to be made great again, because America was always great.
Senator McCain had asked two of his former political rivals to speak, Barack Obama and George W. Bush. They urged the nation to rise above partisanship and division.
It's a politics that pretends to be brave and tough, but in fact is born of fear. John called on us to be bigger than that. He called on us to be better than that.
John's voice will always come as a whisper over our shoulder. We are better than this. America is better than this.
As McCain's coffin made its way to Annapolis on Sunday, mourners waved American flags and cheered the procession. The memorial there was private. Among the speakers were Senator Lindsey Graham and McCain's son Jack, bidding farewell to an American hero who was laid to rest at the place where his life of public service began. Shannon Van Sant, NPR News, Washington.
Syrian refugees who are in Lebanon need all the help they can get. But now They're getting it from a group of anti-immigration extremists from Germany. This group's help comes with a catch. For them, it's part of an effort to keep Muslims out of Europe. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, where she went to meet some refugees.
Raja and her family are refugees from Syria. She's afraid to give her last name, but invites us into her simple home next to some tents where other refugees live. Over coffee, she tells us about the two young German men who arrived at her door some months ago. They told her they were researchers for a charity.
They seemed fine. They just wanted to come in and film the house. We said we have nothing to hide. They filmed everything, even the kitchen.
The men are actually connected to a far-right group in Germany that calls itself the Identitarian Movement. It wants to stop families like Raja's from coming to Europe. She says she wouldn't have let them in if she'd known. Her sister-in-law, Mona, says she'd like to beat them up. The men used the footage of children in Raja's home in a slick new video they posted online to pitch their new plan. Give aid in Lebanon to stop refugees coming to Europe. They call the effort the Alternative Help Association, or AHA. Sven Engeser is in the Identitarian Movement, a leader of AHA, and one of the men who came to Raja's home. He says they told people they were a relief organization focused on local help. Now back in Germany, I reach him by Skype.
We want to save our borders because of the mass immigration to Europe. I think we lost our identity.
He rejects the label far right. He says he's a, quote, patriot, which to him means stopping immigrants, especially Muslims, migrating to Europe.
We want to stop Muslim migration to Europe and to stop support them in Germany. It is a problem because it's not easy to integrate them, and Europe is a Christian continent.
Simon Raphael is from the Amadeo Antonio Stiftung, a Berlin-based group that researches extremist movements. She says, though the identitarians try to cloak it, they are part of Germany's far right.
What they really want is that these ideas are main principles for the whole society in Germany, which they aren't. And so they try to hide their intentions to gain more influence.
She says they promote racism and are so Islamophobic that they don't even consider Muslim citizens Germans. Raphael says authorities are watching the group, worried that though it may number just a few hundred, it has extremist connections and a growing reach on social media. And German aid organizations have warned their partners in Lebanon to steer clear of AHA.
What they do is they misuse the need for refugees in Lebanon for their political goals.
Till Kuster from the German nonprofit Medico International believes AHA is largely an exercise to win the group more support in Germany. There are lots of other groups, including the United Nations, spending hundreds of millions on Syrians in Lebanon. Right now, AHA admits, it's only raised enough funds to pay the rent for 10 refugee families. For some, that's around $100 a month to live in a tent. Mahmoud is one of the recipients, who also asks not to use her full name. She's a widow and lives with her disabled daughter in a basic tent. In the summer heat, it's stifling inside. Mahmoud says the rent payment isn't enough to keep her in Lebanon. She'd still go to Europe if she could. I ask her which country she wants to go to. Germany, she replies. Isn't that the best? Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, the Bekaa Valley, Lebanon.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, right now 8:19, and thanks for listening today. On the way in 15 minutes on this Labor Day, we hear from David Wessel of the Brookings Institution about why wages continue to stagnate despite so much positive news about corporate profits and the economy.
As the kids go back to school, parents, well, they think about the unthinkable.
The taxpayers would be on the hook because the administration would be faced with the same choice we were faced with. Let them collapse and potentially bring down the U.S. economy, or use taxpayer money to bail them out.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How schools work or don't with Arne Duncan. He used to be the Secretary of Education. That's next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace tonight at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the Mount Horeb Area Chamber of Commerce, hosts of the 16th annual Thirsty Troll Brewfest, with different beers from all over the Midwest, this Saturday from 1 to 5. Tickets are still available.
Support for WGTD comes from Frank's Diner, the diner your mother warned you about. Order what you want, eat what you get. Reservations for parties 5 or more, call 262-697-1017. Frank's Diner, Kenosha.com.
In weather for Wisconsin, some dense fog around the state this morning. A few flood warnings remain in effect in parts of southern Wisconsin, and we're expecting a mix of sun and clouds, with rain and thunderstorms possible in the north and likely in the south, with some heavy rain possible, highs from the mid-70s to low 80s. Rain and thunderstorms likely for tomorrow, with highs in the low 70s to mid-80s. Wednesday, a mix of sun and clouds with some rain and thunderstorms possible, highs in the low 70s to low 80s. And on Thursday, clearing off in the north with highs in the upper 60s, rain and thunderstorms in the south with highs in the 80s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Acorn TV, presenting A Place to Call Home, a family saga about love, privilege, secrets, and scandal. Set amid sweeping social changes in 1950s Australia, the new season is streaming now on Acorn TV. From Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. There was an age growing up when my mom let me go anywhere on the block by myself so long as I did not cross the street. A bit later, I could ride my bike about as far as I could go. Surely many kids still grow up that way, but we have entered an era of hyper-attentive parenting when adults tend to hover. Dina Pritchett reports on an organization that sees value in a looser parenting style.
7-year-old Matthew is in the woods behind his Portland condo. It's kind of a classic childhood scene. He lounges on a tire swing, tromps over to his friend's house across the ravine.
Well, we made this path from here all the way down to there.
He made the path himself with the help of a friend using garden shears, and they did it without any adult supervision. Matthew's mom, Laura Randall, wants her son to gain the sort of skills and confidence that only come with doing things yourself. But she didn't just toss her 7-year-old out the door with some hiking boots and garden shears one day. They worked up to it, gradually, with what Randall calls
experiments in independence. Just those moments, you know, incrementally bigger moments where he can choose to be on his own.
Randall knows this isn't the norm in today's parenting, where kids are shuttled from one supervised, structured activity to another. Gone are the days when kids ride their bikes alone until the streetlights come on. And Randall has encountered people who think she's a bad parent, like the man who started yelling at her when she left Matthew alone in the car for a few minutes while she ran into the pharmacy to pick up a prescription.
It was mortifying and frightening, and he identifies himself as a police officer, and I think, oh my gosh.
Randall knows that parents in several states have been arrested for leaving kids unattended, for letting them walk to the park on their own, or even walk to school. And so she was worried about what this man might do.
Then he immediately said something about, do you know how many kids go missing a year? And I was like, by coincidence, I think I do know. And it's very small.
They talked it out, and the man eventually threw up his hands and walked away. Randall's heart was pounding, but she felt confident defending her parenting, partly because she had connected with a group called Free Range Kids, which promotes childhood independence and gives families the information they need to push back against a culture of overprotection. Its founder is Lenora Scanese.
This very pessimistic, fearful way of looking at childhood isn't based in reality. It is something that we have been taught.
Scanese now has a new project called Let Grow, which aims to create communities where childhood independence is the norm.
We have two projects that are really simple, like almost laughably simple, but I think they're working.
Let Grow is reaching out to elementary schools across the country to assign kids independence homework. Every week, the kids decide to do something on their own that they haven't done before, whether it's walking the dog around the block, or making dinner, or walking a few aisles over in the supermarket to get some eggs. The school's also set up Let Grow play clubs. Mixed ages, no structure, and no adult direction. Just free, child-led play. Lori Kerner is principal at Tremont Elementary in Long Island, one of a dozen New York schools piloting the project.
We saw a direct effect in the classroom. The children were just more self-assured and confident.
Kerner says with Let Grow, kids discover skills and abilities they didn't know they had. And they also discover what it's like to fail.
If we don't offer them these opportunities to communicate, to collaborate, to problem solve, then how can they be successful in a global society?
And that success, ultimately, is what parents want for their kids. Parents like Laura Randall.
There's the short game where you're sort of doing the best you can in the moment, but there's the long game, and there's paying attention to allowing a little risk because it will pay off in the long run.
Randall understands that life has real risks, but so does getting in a car. And most of us still do it every day because that's how we get where we want to go. For Matthew to become a confident, competent adult, Randall wants him to go outside, make his own mistakes, and figure things out. And she hopes he won't be the only kid out there doing it. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichep in Portland, Oregon.
All right, consumers who buy their insurance through the Affordable Care Act markets might be pleasantly surprised about their premium costs come this fall. The price of premiums could actually drop in several states, as NPR's Allison Kojak reports.
Prices for Affordable Care Act health plans look like they're going to rise less than 4% next year. That estimate, based on the website acasignups.net, is based on insurance companies' early filings in all 50 states.
The news about the marketplace this year is very good, both in terms of the premium increase and the extent of carrier participation.
That's Catherine Hempstead, a senior policy advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which supports NPR's coverage of health. She says premiums are rising on average at about the same rate as medical inflation. That's a big change from the double-digit rate increases in the last few years.
And we're seeing that the double-digit kinds of increases are occurring in a small handful of states.
For example, Kentucky and Connecticut.
But they're definitely the exception. In quite a few states, we're actually seeing premiums going down.
Like in New Hampshire, where prices are expected to fall about 13%, and Tennessee, where they could drop 11%. And Hempstead says more insurance companies are offering more policies in more states.
After a very sort of tortured birth and infancy, it sort of seems like the market is in some ways, you know, at a very stable place right now.
She says insurance companies have figured out how to make a profit from the policies they sell on the ACA exchanges. So now they're expanding their offerings. But premiums would actually be falling next year, but for the actions of the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress, says Charles Gaba, who tracks just about everything about the ACA on his website, acasignups.net. Those actions include getting rid of the tax penalty for those people who don't buy health insurance and encouraging insurers to sell stripped-down short-term policies. Both moves are draining healthy young people out of the ACA market.
The reality is that if you didn't have those factors, if you didn't have the expansion of short-term plans, and especially the repeal of the mandate penalty for next year, average premiums would most likely be dropping by a good 4 or 5%.
Whether premiums go up or down, consumers who qualify for a subsidy will likely pay just about the same for their insurance next year as they're paying now. Open enrollment on the federal exchange and in most states begins November 1st. Allison Kojak, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Facebook is starting a new effort to disclose who's paying for ads to fight against foreign powers trying to influence elections. But is it enough?
This technology landscape is changing so quickly that I'm worried that voters don't fully grok how to tell truth apart from advertising, from disinformation.
I'm Ari Shapiro, Transparency on Social Media, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Morning Edition on WPR. News is just ahead, including a story about Wisconsin's record-breaking amounts of precipitation over the last 10 years. That and more news in just a few minutes.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The latest numbers on employment in the U.S. are due out later this week. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Recent economic data indicate growth is continuing as consumers spend more and as inflation increases. Last week, the Commerce Department reported personal and government spending increased, consumer spending at a rate of 0.4% in July. Inflation is also reaching the Federal Reserve's target levels of 2%. That resolved some of the central bank's concerns that prices were not increasing in spite of a strong job market and robust demand for goods and services. Now the question is whether wages will keep pace with those increases. As prices creep higher, that raises new questions about whether that will cut into consumers' ability to afford goods in the future. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The International Court of Justice is hearing arguments this week over the legality of Britain's claim to the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. The BBC's Anna Holligan says Mauritius accuses the UK of forcibly evicting the entire population for the construction of a US airbase.
The UK argues that the Chagos Islands were only administered by Mauritius as a matter of convenience and says the UK paid $4.2 million for the territory. Mauritius claims the agreement was made under duress.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Wisconsin had its wettest five-year period on record between 2013 and 2017 with more than 186 inches of precipitation. Data from the National Centers for Environmental Information shows the 10-year period between 2008 and 2017 was the wettest on record for Wisconsin since 1895. Steve Vavras is a senior scientist with the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research.
We've been seeing an increase in heavy rainfalls, not just around the state, but around the whole country. Every region of the country has seen an increase in extreme rainfall over the last few decades, and we're certainly no exception.
Favre says the Earth's warming surface increases evaporation of the Earth's oceans, lakes, and soil. The added moisture in the atmosphere leads to more rainfall. Authorities say they were trying to arrest a Wisconsin man on a domestic abuse-related charge when he fled in an airplane and then crashed into a cornfield. The Winnebago County Sheriff's Office says officers went to Whitman Regional Airport in Oshkosh on Friday night to try to arrest the 47-year-old for violating a restraining order and other charges. For 18 days, investigators had checked locations he was known to frequent, including the hangar where he kept his plane. The department says he took off despite instructions from the control tower to hold until officers arrived. He almost hit an Oshkosh police car before becoming airborne. The twin-engine plane crashed about 2 hours later near Wapaka, about 40 miles away. The pilot was hospitalized with serious injuries that weren't life-threatening. Charges are pending in connection to the plane incident. Longtime Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abrahamson says she has cancer. The 84-year-old Abrahamson in May announced that she was not seeking re-election next year after disclosing a month earlier that she was undergoing medical treatment. In an open letter Friday, she disclosed for the first time that she has cancer. Abrahamson does not say when she was diagnosed or what type of cancer she has. She says she intends to appear in court to finish out the last year of her term, but maybe in a wheelchair. In weather, some dense fog this morning, a mix of sun and clouds, rain and thunderstorms possible in the north and likely in the south, highs from the mid-70s to low 80s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Trader Joe's, offering the original podcast series Inside Trader Joe's, bringing you the stories behind the store. New episodes available at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. More at TraderJoe's.com. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing justice and opportunity for people in need. More information at publicwelfare.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. The stock market hit a record high the other day. Employment is also running high. They have been for years, the very conditions that tend to push up wages. So why isn't that happening? David Wessel is here to talk with us about that. He is at the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. Welcome back, David.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
A couple of years ago, it seemed that wages were finally climbing. What's happened since?
Well, I think a good yardstick is to look at what happens to the wages of people who work full-time year-round. And according to the Census Bureau, the typical man earns about $54,000 a year. The typical woman earns about $43,000 a year. Hmm. Adjusted for inflation, the typical man who works full-time is earning less today than his counterpart did in 1988.
Wow.
I think that's extraordinary. Now, more recently, as you point out, wages have begun to go up, but they haven't gone up much more than inflation. It depends month to month what's happening. So adjusted for inflation, wages are basically flat, even though we have unemployment at an 18-year low.
Why would that be?
Well, that's a good question. It's one that economists in academia, all the way up to the chairman of the Federal Reserve, have been asking recently. And I think there are a couple of possible explanations. One is that the unemployment rate is misleading. There are a lot of workers on the sidelines of the economy, and they're being pulled in by the recovery. Another is that productivity has been growing very slowly. Rising productivity growth is the way that employers can afford to raise wages and maintain profits. So you would expect wages to be growing sluggishly when productivity growth is low. But in many ways, I think what's going on is that workers simply have less bargaining power today than they once did. Unions are weaker. There's an explosion of temp agencies and outsourcing in the gig economy. And in lots of communities across the country, very few employers dominate the labor market so that workers have no choice but to work for them. In some communities, for instance, it's the hospital. So that means employers aren't competing for workers by raising wages, and that depresses them.
Anand Giridharadas, a writer who was on the program the other day, put out a book about inequities in the economy and suggested that essentially productivity is going up, but that the economy has changed in ways that people at the top are able to hold on to more and more and more of those gains and not share.
I think that's true. Productivity is growing. It's just growing at a disappointingly slow pace. But it's true that the benefits of the growing economy are being increasingly claimed by people at the top.
So what does this mean if you're Jerome Powell running the Federal Reserve or any number of the other people who are in positions of power and are supposed to influence the economy?
Well, what they refer to at the Fed as the wage puzzle is really central to their decision-making on interest rates today. Usually, history tells us that when an unemployment rate goes way, way down, wages start to go up and then businesses start to raise prices and you have more inflation. But that relationship isn't holding now. So the Fed has to decide, is something really different in the economy? Is this a permanent change? Or are wage increases just around the corner, in which case they should be raising rates more rapidly than they are?
Is this wage stagnation the same for every kind of person?
No, of course not. We're talking about averages. Wages actually are going up a little faster at the bottom than they are for people at the middle. Yes, the best paid people, CEOs, lawyers of big law firms, the best ball players, they're doing very well. But when we look at the data, it turns out that things like raising the minimum wage, which has happened in 18 states this year, that's beginning to lift the wages of the least paid people in the economy a little more than the typical worker at the middle.
David Wessel of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The president of Guatemala, Jimmy Morales, came to office promising to end corruption, but he's also under investigation by an anti-corruption commission backed by the United Nations. And so he took things in his own hands and decided to shut the commission down. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala is known by its Spanish acronym, CICIG. It was created 12 years ago in concert with the United Nations around the idea that military and government elites cannot continue plundering public funds if this enfeebled country was to move forward after three decades of savage civil war. Since then, the commission has racked up an impressive record, 310 convictions, 34 legal reforms submitted to the Guatemalan Congress, two former presidents currently in jail on corruption charges, and the sitting president is under investigation for campaign finance shenanigans.
CICIG is this great international experiment in criminal investigation and judicial reform, and there's not been anything like it anywhere in the world.
Kate Doyle is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive and a veteran of human rights work in Guatemala.
President Morales' decision to cancel the mandate of CICIG and essentially order its investigations to come to a grinding halt is a terrible blow to the progress that Guatemala has made in justice.
President Morales announced Friday he will not renew the mandate of CICIG when it expires in 12 months, and that it's time to transfer their mission to the Guatemalan Attorney General's office. Morales appeared in front of a phalanx of dozens of stern military officials, and shortly before his press conference, a column of olive-green jeeps with soldiers and machine gun turrets rolled past CICIG headquarters. The U.S. Embassy, which gave the armed vehicles to the police for crime fighting, warned Guatemala not to misuse them. The embassy also reaffirmed its support for CICIG. The United States is a major financial backer of the Anti-Graft Commission. Guatemalan observers consider the use of security forces in these two instances on Friday to be a menacing replay of the bad old days of the 1980s when military coups made Guatemala a pariah state in Latin America. The president has chosen to take the side of illegality, says longtime Guatemalan human rights lawyer Alejandro Rodriguez. This is extremely grave. The message the president has sent is basically a coup d'etat. The military procession clearly rattled workers inside CICIG. Matias Ponce is their spokesman.
As an international organization, you know, we have the immunities and we expect that the government protect our headquarters. And if you see militaries outside, it's not a good signal for an international body.
President Morales has accused CICIG of sowing judicial terror. He's being investigated for using illegal campaign donations to bankroll his 2015 election, and his brother and one of his sons were arrested for fraud. Gauging from a dozen interviews in the plaza in front of the Greenstone National Palace yesterday, the work of CICIG remains popular, and the president's decision to kick them out of the country is troubling. CICIG is working correctly to combat all the corrupt government officials, says Dora Solis, a 64-year-old housewife. It's they who stand to lose if CICIG continues to do its work in Guatemala. To bring it home to Americans, one longtime Guatemala watcher put it this way. Imagine that President Trump wakes up one morning and announces he's shutting down the Mueller investigation. That's what just happened in Guatemala. John Burnett, NPR News, Guatemala City.
This is NPR News.
Morning edition on WPR. Coming up in 9 minutes, we'll hear about Catherine Marsh's new book, Nowhere Boy. It's the story of a 14-year-old Syrian refugee who has relocated to Brussels and his friendship with an American boy, plus the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio just after 9.
This election season, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking Wisconsinites what's important to them. And we're meeting them where they are, out in the community.
Are you going to vote in this fall's elections?
Oh, you bet your booties I vote in every election.
And this is the easiest possible way to get involved in government.
The need to take democracy seriously is more important than ever.
Tell us what's important to you. Call our hotline at 877-782-8942.
Support for WPR comes from Old Brick Botanical Gardens, presenting Gleam, Art in a New Light, with nighttime light-based exhibits throughout the gardens and conservatory, Wednesday through Saturday evenings, now through October. More at oldbrick.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. It's patio season, which means alfresco dining at Jack's Cafe. Stop by and enjoy the sun along with breezy summer cafe soda fountain specials. Proudly serving the Kenosha community since 1911. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha.
Listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. And here's what we know about the flooding that has been plaguing the state for a couple of weeks now. A few localized flood warnings remain in effect, including some for the Baraboo, Rock, Fox, and Crawfish Rivers, and a number of roads are still closed. Water levels of the four Yahara River lakes rose yesterday from overnight rain as the National Weather Service extended a flood warning for Madison. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Lake Mendota and Lakes Mendota and Caganza rose by an inch by Sunday morning. Lakes Monona and Wabisa rose 1.5 inches. We'll pass along updates as we get them. And in the meantime, visit our website for all the latest information on flooding in the state. That's WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. From Charles Schwab, who believes a modern approach to wealth management starts with asking questions and providing straightforward answers. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Had things gone according to plan, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo would have been back from fresh talks with North Korea by now. Instead, President Trump canceled last week's trip. Those watching for progress in the talks include families of some 5,000 American soldiers still unaccounted for on North Korean territory. Here's Jay Price of member station WUNC.
In a hotel not far from Arlington National Cemetery, nearly 800 people fill a vast meeting room, and nearly every one has a story of loss that's rippled through generations.
He went down, leaving my mother with 5 children under the age of 7.
I was 3 years old. My sister was born 3 days later.
My grandfather was so distraught, not with just the loss, but the unknown, he ended up taking his own life.
Every year, the federal government invites the families of Korean War missing to a meeting like this. They hear updates on diplomatic efforts with North Korea, learn about advances in the science of identifying long-buried remains, and go into back rooms for private updates on their individual cases.
You come each year hoping to have just a little bit of new news or glimmer of hope or possibility that maybe, maybe one day we'll bring him home.
Jennifer Castaldi of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, has been coming to these meetings for nearly a decade. She calls it a mission to bring closure to her family. Her uncle, PFC Marshall Bush, the family called him Lynn, vanished in late 1950 during notoriously fierce fighting near the Chosin Reservoir.
And my uncle Lynn writes, "Dear folks, I'm hoping that this letter finds you all well."
8 days earlier, he had mailed his last letter home.
All of the boys are talking about what they're going to do when they get home, and I've been thinking of the same thing.
Attendance at this year's meeting was the largest ever, and there was good news on several fronts. Just days earlier, 55 new boxes of remains reached the United States, one with a dog tag, which was presented to the family. And military officials said they'll disinter hundreds of other unidentified U.S. remains that were buried in Hawaii shortly after the war. Families are optimistic that advances in DNA science will help identify many of those service members, too.
I've been to a few meetings where there was nothing positive shared. No information. Families were crying, frustrated, yelling at each other. And that's not the atmosphere now.
The efforts that the United States takes to recover and identify its war missing are unique and relatively recent. They began in the mid-1960s when families of Vietnam POWs and MIAs started organizing. Family members say the Pentagon agency overseeing the work was dysfunctional until it was reorganized 3 years ago.
In terms of the families, we were not a partner. It was hard to get information. It was hard to get cooperation.
Richard Downs is president of the Coalition of Families of Korean and Cold War POW/MIAs.
And then something happened to the chemistry of it all. They call us. The exchanges are on the highest level now.
He says, though, there have been too many ups and downs in the volatile relations between the U.S. and North Korea to feel confident about a permanent thaw or getting U.S. recovery teams back into the reclusive country.
We're at a tipping point. These things have happened before, and we've tipped backwards. We hope this time to tip forward.
Another hope for the families, that they'll soon have something more of their missing relatives than just memories and old letters.
Well, there isn't anything else to write about, so until next time, adios.
For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Alexandria, Virginia.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're almost at the end of the program, but we'll have all the latest news, including updates on the flood situation this afternoon on All Things Considered, starting at 4 o'clock.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Riverbend and Racine will have an informative session about hummingbirds and why they're important to our ecosystem on September 6th at 6:30 p.m. The class is free and open to the public. Visit riverbendracine.org for more details.
Molly, Turkey, and more will perform free concerts throughout both days. WPR is pleased to celebrate music from around Wisconsin and the world. Find information at wpr.org/events.
Stay tuned for Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins here on WPR. In the first hour, a divertimento by Mozart and Kentucky Mountain Portraits by Lyndall Mitchell. And then in the 10 o'clock hour, The Other Rhapsody by George Gershwin, the second rhapsody. Stay tuned. Music starts in about 15 minutes. Some dense fog around the state this morning and a few localized flood warnings in southern Wisconsin. A mix of sun and clouds today with rain and thunderstorms possible in the north, likely in the south. Some heavy rain possible and highs from the mid-70s to low 80s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Nowhere Boy is a young adult novel about Ahmed, a Syrian refugee whose father dies on the journey to Europe. Ahmed and his father were originally trying to get to England, but now as an orphan alone in Brussels, that dream fades. Instead, he finds himself hiding in a house where an American family is living. Here's the author, Catherine Marsh.
Ahmed realized what he was thinking, but he pushed the idea away. Someone would find him. He would be arrested for breaking into the house. But the idea wouldn't leave him. He had no money, no phone. He had nothing, just a fake passport and a watch. Not even bus fare to get back to the refugee camp at Park Maximilian.
The author sat down with Rachel Martin.
Tell us about the family who was living upstairs.
So there's an American family living in the house, and the father has come to work for NATO, and they have a son who is 13 years old named Max. He is in a family of achievers, and he himself has not been an achiever, and this is a fresh start for him, but he really does not want to be there.
He ends up discovering this boy who's living in his basement, and he connects with him. He feels like an outsider in some ways in Belgium. Obviously, Ahmed is an outsider to the extreme. He is having to hide himself. He can't go to school. He can't be part of normal society. And Max decides that that's not fair, that that is an injustice, and he wants to help him change that.
Yes, and that's right. The character of Max is very much based on the experience of our family who came to Brussels as expats, and he feels very lost there. And I wanted to write a book in which I had a character who really was outside of his comfort zone. And it's something that I wanted to write about because I feel like as Americans, we often don't feel outside of our comfort zones. And particularly at this time, in this moment, we cling to our comfort zones. And I wanted children, American children, who maybe don't see themselves as outsiders, to imagine themselves as being outsiders in the world.
So what was happening at the time that your family was in Belgium? I mean, this was, you were there when the refugee crisis was at its height, right?
That's right. And it's interesting because we arrived in Brussels in the summer of 2015, and that year was the height of the refugee crisis. There were more refugees coming into Europe. I think it was about 1 million that year. There was also a lot of news events that year, including the Brussels lockdown following the Paris terror attacks, and then in the spring of 2016, Brussels had a terror attack. And that brought up a lot of issues that I thought would be interesting to write about.
So conversations, difficult conversations, inevitably, that you had to have with your own kids.
Exactly. I mean, the schools closed down when we had the Brussels lockdown. And I actually had to explain to my children why they weren't going to school and what was happening. And it was interesting because when we lived in America, I did talk with them about the threat of gun violence and what to do. And I thought I wouldn't be having those conversations when I got to Europe. Instead, I was having another type of conversation, which was what to do in case of a terrorist attack.
What about the refugee crisis itself and how it was playing out? I mean, where did you see that manifest in your life? Did you, as a family?
Yes, definitely. So Parc Maximilien, which is one of the central urban parks of Brussels, became a Red Cross camp for refugees. And, you know, when you went in that area, you would actually see a number of refugees camping outside, waiting to try to get some sort of immigration status. You would see refugees occasionally on the street asking for money. There are a lot of neighbors and friends we knew who ended up doing volunteer work to help refugees. So that was just part of daily life. In addition, you know, you'd hear a lot of different opinions about the refugees, ranging from people who felt that Europe needed to keep them out, that they were threatening what Europe was, to ones that were more welcoming, but were dealing with these real questions of how do we integrate this many people into our society and what's the best way to do that.
So this is big stuff. I mean, these are big issues. Terrorism, integration, the refugee crisis, right from the get-go in this book, in the first few pages, Ahmed is going through this loss as he's trying to get from one place to another and loses his dad in the process. And I know this is a question that authors who write young adult fiction always get, but how do you parse those themes, those very complicated, deeply emotional ideas? How do you present them to a young audience?
That's such a wonderful question, and I love to answer it because not only am I an author, but I'm a parent of children. And I wrote this book in part because I wanted to help my children process this year in Europe. And I think that there are ways to write for children without being overtly graphic, but at the same time being honest. And I think it's important because kids do observe the world, they do see a lot, and they pick up on attitudes particularly. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this book is to really start to separate feelings and facts, which was a real problem in Europe where people were having a lot of strong feelings about things, but they weren't always connected to the facts on the ground. For example, people said, you know, they're refugees and, you know, they're terrorists. And, you know, the truth was that most of the terrorists were actually born in Europe. Now, for children, children love stories. And this, at its heart, is a story. It's an adventure story. It's a story about friendship. It's a story about belonging. And I think when I tell a story for children that may have these larger ideas in it, I try to keep to the idea of connecting you to the character's specific experience rather than talking in a large, pedantic way about it.
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit, I was near the end of the book and my six-year-old happened to be looking over my shoulder. And all of a sudden, I'm reading out loud to him. He doesn't know what's going on in the world. He's still just six, but he was captivated about what was happening to those two boys.
Yes.
And kept wanting me to go, read on, Mommy, what is happening to those boys?
I mean, I think good children's literature works on a variety of levels, and there should be something that you as an adult bring to it just because you know the true horrors of some of this, and then a child can read it and focus on different parts of it.
Right. So even though he's only six, at the end of it, and we'd only read a little bit, but I got the excuse to talk to him about a refugee. What is a refugee? Who is a refugee? And we hadn't had that conversation before.
That's great.
Do you think about those people who you saw in Maximilien Park and wonder who
Absolutely.
They are?
Absolutely. I mean, I think of all the people. And one of the things I did, because my background is as a journalist, so I felt in order to be responsible as an author, I needed to do the reporting to get that Syrian perspective. So what I did is I went out and I interviewed a number of people, both Syrian refugees, unaccompanied minor, people who worked with refugees, and I tried to get as much kind of factual detail as possible in order to bring that character and his experience to life.
The book is called Nowhere Boy. The author is Catherine Marsh. We've been talking about her book here in our studios in Washington. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
You can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And to follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. A minute before 9 now. Headlines and music are next.
Marketplace, Fresh Air. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you.
Support comes from the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Eat, drink, and be merry. Succulent treats, sinful sweets, dashing and clashing nights, music and laughter. The Bristol Renaissance Fair is open weekends through Labor Day, located just west of I-94 near the state line.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.